to the Jeff Horst Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning, 34 minutes after the hour. Still come on the program, Josh Moon, Alabama political reporter. That's in about an hour from now. Justin Mogi of the Alabama Policy Institute will be with us at the 11 o'clock hour. We'll wrap it all up with State Senator David's sessions. Will be with us. That's in the 11:30 block, so please stay tuned for all of that. But join us now. It is Tuesday, and we talk to Dan Gaynor from the Media Research Center about this time every week, sometimes a little later. But, Dan, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. And so how about a blast from the past for both of us? You and I were at the front end, the cutting edge of conservatives who were blocked by Meghan McCain. And, back when her early days, when she was – because she's – I think it's fair to say not hardcore right wing, much like her father. There are areas in which we agree with her, areas which we didn't. But since social media was still relatively new, if you dared criticize her from the right, you were kicked to the curb. Well, she just left The View and had some choice words for her critics on The View, Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar, who were at times very abusive towards her on the show, and it turns out not just on air, but off air as well. And so they couldn't handle even her brand of conservatism, so they forced her off the show, because that's the way media is now, that if you dare disagree with them one iota, you're kicked to the curb. You're a right-wing fanatic. And speaking of somebody who is blocked by her, I can tell you she's not exactly all that right wing.
Well, I tell you what this is indicative of to me, Scene. I mean, people make politics their identity. Like that's what they. It goes beyond just like you're a Ravens fan, but people don't think of you as, hey, it's that Ravens guy. But people think of Joy Behar and maybe older people think differently of Joy Behar and Whoopi Goldberg, but now they're those two liberal crazy women on The View, like that's their whole identity, their whole purpose in life is politics. And it's not a good place to get information from, ladies and gentlemen, when you make that your identity.
Well, and also The View, not a good place to get information from.
Generally, no.
The View is among the most insipid locations on television. So to Meghan McCain's credit, she at least brought a little bit of balance some of the time. I didn't always agree with her. I don't think I'll always agree with her on anything. But she deserves credit for that. And you're right. Many conservatives are hardcore church-going Christians, or people of faith in general, Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or whatever. And if they go to church or synagogue or mosque, that's the defining characteristic of them. And so their faith will come up in conversation. They'll talk about going to church or doing good works, to do volunteer work, etc. But for people who are into politics, and there are way too many of them in Washington like this, politics defines everything they do. They get angry about, like, oh my gosh, this guy said such and such, and you go, who?
But I guess the difference there is most of those people in Washington D.C. they make a living out of it. They do it for a living. Because it's like what I do. I mean, I don't necessarily get as emotional about politics, and probably my listeners would like me to get a little more emotional, but I'm interested in it. I like the history, the psychology, and all of that. It's when people make it about themselves, though, right? That they put the jersey on. They make it all about themselves, and they judge other people. They're not open to other, in this case, they're not open to Meghan McCain's point of view or anything right of center. And that's where it gets a little just, not only obnoxious, but kind of creepy, actually.
So to segue appropriately from that into the death of Colin Powell. Colin Powell was, for folks who remember, he was wildly popular when he left the military. And he was African-American Republican. And there was a lot of talk about him maybe running for president. He talked that he might have been the first, black president. And I went to Colin Powell's coming out party. He gave a speech for the Jewish National Fund in Baltimore. It was his first event. Not really sure how they managed to get him, but they did, and I got a ticket. And it was, you know, like, oh, wow, this is real interesting. This is cool. It's political. But eventually, you know, his politics came out that he was much more liberal in a lot of things. And so he had a falling out with the Republican Party and did a lot of support for Democrats. But still, when he passed away yesterday, you know, I saw a lot of conservatives going out there and saying, you know, rest in peace and prayers for him and not grave dancing, even though they'd had, you know, a lot of issues with him. And you look at the left, when someone passes away, they just don't do that. They celebrate the death of somebody. You know, talk radio hosts who have died in the last year, some of whom died from COVID, and I'm like, oh, serves them right. Like, who thinks like that?
I mean, Joy Reid.
Who's got such an empty spot in their soul that they're, I mean, Jesse Jackson got sick from COVID. Jesse Jackson is more liberal than I could be in a thousand lifetimes. But he's still a human being. And so you pray that he beats COVID. And so, I mean, it's like, I just don't get that.
But that gets back to the point. When somebody makes it their whole identity and they make it so personal, that's absolutely what that leads to. That's the kind of behavior you see on that individual. Joy Reid, that was one of her segments was like all the bad stuff Colin Powell had done during his career, going all the way back to Reagan. And then obviously the Bush years and the UN Security Council and everything. And then it's like we need to remember why these guys were bad, and that's what the left does. But they are more likely, tell me if you think this is true, they're more likely to be the ones to make that their brand, their image, that their politics are them. And, you know, somebody for Joy Reid, I guess, she does it for TV for a living. Maybe it's half of it's an act. But there are real people that follow that template in their lives, their day-to-day lives, and they go through life this way, thinking of everything through the lens of a political point of view.
Well, I mean, it can lead to crazy things. I mean, it can lead to, you know, the guy who tried to murder Republican members of Congress. Scalise. It can lead to people attacking other people on the street. I'm against all that. I just am. I mean, I think it's, you know, I'd like to think we could sort out our problems debating or something. When, you know, people get to the point where they go and harm other people. Even there are some, apparently Brian Stelter talked about there. Apparently there's some stalker guy who's apparently even being criminally charged for threats against Stelter. And I've got a gazillion things that I don't like about Brian Stelter, positions and comments and things he does, etc. But I would never wish a stalker on him or that, you know, to wish harm on him. That's nuts. Well, and by the way,
how far down the list you got to go to be the guy that wants to stalk Brian Stelter? Like, you know, was Jim Acosta, you know, not on the list? Like you went all the way. You really are bottom feeding at that point if you're a stalker.
Yeah, crazy people do crazy things. I mean, the guy who attacked Reagan because of, you know, what was the actress's
Jodie
name?
Jodie
Foster, yeah. It's like, okay, that's a weird. I mean, that, you know, just crazy people do crazy stuff, and it's always unfortunate and it's sad. There's a difference between crazy and evil, and, you know, crazy people can do evil things. Evil people always do evil things, and so, you know, you got the attacker, the Muslim terrorist who murdered a British member of Parliament, you know, a couple of days ago. That is different. Stalkers will stalk people and might harm people, but a lot of the stalkers are just nuts. You know, something has gone wrong in their life or whatever. I feel bad for people like that. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be, you know, dealt with in the justice system. It's just there's a different kind of thing. And so the left has managed, though, to try to create a privileged class for journalists and politicians. And so, and Facebook is now enforcing it. Facebook's creating new rules to limit how much you can criticize and what you can say about people who are journalists. I don't know. Okay, this doesn't end well. You know that sooner or later somebody's going to say, well, you know, Brian Stelter's a jerk because he said this, and you get banned from from social media. Like, well, that's they want to be insulated. They don't want to, they want all the fame and none of the criticism.
Well, that's going to backfire eventually. That you'll just create other. You'll just create other places where these people can go and sound off on who they like or don't like. But anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, you see with Dave Chappelle, right. How much people are freaked out. Oh, Dave Chappelle made trans jokes. Every group gets made fun of.
Well, like
every group.
If Donald Trump tomorrow says, I am going to start using this social media platform. I think you see a lot of people maybe gravitate toward that. Now, some of these guys are trying to, you know, I think build something that he'll use and base their business model off his popularity and the people that would follow. But you get enough of these heavy hitters, these big names, these Dave Chappelle's and Trump's and et cetera, and you don't screw up like Parler did, then maybe it becomes something where that, you know, Facebook and it becomes MySpace or something like that, right? It's going to take maybe a decade or so, but these social media internet phenomenon, they don't last forever, at least in the brief history of the internet. The AOLs go away, the MySpaces go away. You think of these tech giant Yahoos, you know, not what it once was. They tend not to last forever, right?
Right. So, and I mean, I think you're right. You're saying something I got quoted saying, basically, that, you know, that these companies need to attract the other people, the Rihannas, the Britney Spears, the, you know, the Kyrie Irving, you know, people who are pushing for free speech in some different ways. You know, Nicki Minaj. You know, I follow Nicki Minaj now on Instagram. I'm not a fan of her music. I don't think I ever will be. But I'm a fan if she's willing to speak up and talk about, you know, disagreeing and just being willing to push free speech. That's something. So if it's one of these platforms, you know, let's say Getter, you know, really, you know, the Jason Miller platform that can really carve out that niche. Yeah, the more that the left kicks people to the curb, you know, the more that chances that will happen. The reason why Twitter is so important is because so many journalists and politicians are on it. And so what you say can get picked up by important people. But if you can drag some of the important people to another platform, enough of their fans will go that then journalists will have to follow.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's just a matter of time. It may take 10, 20 years, but like I said, these things, it'll last forever. You know, let me go check my CompuServe account. Like, you know, the internet's just, it moves so fast. Now, I guess sometimes, you know, these companies will buy up the Instagram or the TikTok or whatever. But at some point that something better will come around and, you know,
it always TikTok. Does. TikTok's a great example of this. TikTok, you know, now, of course, it runs through China, which means the Chinese government has massive influence on it. But it's got a billion users already. A billion users. I can't even wrap my brain around that.
I don't even know what's the difference in TikTok and Instagram. Like I don't understand. This is just what's the appeal? That is, some of this is just
young people like it. That's what the appeal is.
It just catches on, right?
Yep. And you know, young people, it started out as very, very short videos, and it's got an aesthetic all its own about, you know, how people do the videos, and there's a lot of, you know, short, goofy trends, and, you know, it's not, I mean, what happens is all these things start as niche things, but they catch on, and then more staid, normal stuff like news and entertainment, you know, they gravitate towards them. But that's not what TikTok started at. It's just everybody's like, oh, I guess if everybody's over on TikTok, we better do TikTok videos. You know, we've said news executives across the world, and, you know, literally wincing as they say it.
Yeah. Well, especially local news, it's just like these sad news directors want to get that, try to figure out ways to capture that demo. So they make their reporters, aside from having to hold a camera and go do their own spot interviews, everything's so cut short. They make them do the Facebook post and Facebook Live everything. And eventually, that's not going to be where you get the demo. That's going to be where grandma and grandpa still go to get the news, right? I mean,
yeah, and then they'll have to TikTok it. And so what everybody is being asked of is to be this sort of multimedia personality. And that's great, but it's an almost 24/7 job. And what journalism and news media and media in general have done a lousy job about is paying such people. And so then you get the people like Barry Weiss from the New York Times, who leaves under, you know, the whole controversy in New York Times. And she goes to Substack, and now she's got 100,000 subscribers. Just Barry Weiss. And then she becomes a media entity all her own.
It's the lost art of writing. People are not writing. They're doing the art is now social media, I suppose. Hey, Dan, up against the break, unfortunately. Tell folks where to find you if they want to check out the Media Research Center or your columns on foxnews.com.
They can, first of all, you should go to newsbusters.org, our big blog. Go to mrc.org. It's the end of the year, and we're a nonprofit. You can either sign up for newsletters or contribute to us there. Tax deductible, yay. Find me on Twitter at Dan Gaynor, DanGainor. And I write regularly for Fox News Opinion.
Dan, as always, we appreciate it. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks. You can count on it. Take care.
Thanks. Hey, Gaynor, the Media Research Center. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Paul Show at FM Talk 106.5.
Cleveland's cold, so the story ends, we're told. I don't need your prayers, it's true. Save a few.
Mount Chihuahua is my Everest, and the Coosa is my now. Alabama's where I was born and raised, and I think I'll stay a while. We sing about sweet home.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porter Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning, 55 minutes after the hour. So come on the program, Josh Boone, Alabama political reporter from the Alabama Policy Institute, Justin Bogie, and David Sessions, state senator from Grand Bay, will join us. 251-343-0106. You want to respond to anything we are discussing this morning. And let's think about this. We're talking about Meghan McCain in the last segment, daughter of the late Senator John McCain. And she is leaving The View because of toxic treatment or something. You know what I think is really going on here, guys? Now, I'm not saying that the treatment wasn't toxic, but why speak out? And you had to know this, right? You had to know that it was going to be, you're going to be outnumbered by a bunch of crazy left wingers to one milk toast, sort of kind of conservative. She's gaming for a deal with Fox News. She's gaming for a contract with Fox News. Maybe she's on Fox and Friends on the weekends, or she, you know, they have the rotating host show comes on before Tucker. Speaking of Tucker, Tucker will be on with us later this week. Talk about his new book and some other things going on with Tucker Carlson. I think we got him for Thursday. Tucker Carlson coming on the Jeff Porter Show to talk about why he hired me. I think it was 2010, yes. And I got to work for Tucker Carlson for 3 years, and then I went to Breitbart. That was a culture shock. But anyway, he'll be with us. We'll talk about his new book and some other things coming up later in the week. And probably some other big-name guests just have fallen into my lap this week. But we'll disclose that detail once those things are nailed down. But I think Meghan McCain's totally gaming for her next contract. That's what it looks like to me. And we've spent way too much time talking about Meghan McCain. Yes, she has. She did block me on Twitter in like 2008 or something, and I can't remember why. It was. I just replied to somebody making fun of her and thought it was funny, and that got me blocked. And I'm blocked by her husband, Ben Dominic of the Federalist, for some reason. So they stick together with their blocked list. Not that that matters at all. It's just kind of an amusing. It's just amusing to me. 251-343-0106. We'll get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. Looking back again. Cotton on the
roadside cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich.
From Buck's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between, an insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning. We do appreciate it. 251-343-0106. If you would like to weigh in on anything we are discussing this morning, so come on the program. Josh Boone from Alabama Political Reporter. That's coming up in about 30 minutes. Also on the program, Justin Boogie from the Alabama Policy Institute. And then we will wind her down with State Senator David Sessions. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Josh Boone coming up. You're like, whoa, why are you having that guy on? Because I think Josh puts it to work more maybe than some of his left-wing journalist brother, so-called journalist brethren at AL.com. But also, we bring this up from time to time, guys. And by the way, 251-343-0106. But the last few days, or I guess the last few shows, we've really been hitting these shortages in school cafeterias of food. Yes, the supply chain issues. More on that in a moment. I'm going to tell you about this Washington Post op-ed you get a kick out of. But these supply chain problems have hit school lunchrooms, have hit school systems that, you know, how many of you ate the school lunch in your public school days? That's a private school, guys. Y'all might have had it maybe a little similar, but public schools we had. We had interesting ways they had to meet certain nutritional guidelines or dietary guidelines. Now, the federal government pays for a lot of it. But the idea is you can't learn on an empty stomach. And therefore, let's make sure that these school kids have something to eat at least. Okay. Fair enough. And someone will even go as far to say this is the only hot meal some of these kids get. And then that's a whole different discussion, okay? If parents can't feed their kids, the bare minimum of parenting, maybe keeping them from getting run over by a car playing out in the street or huffing glue or something, feed your children. But we decided as society a long time ago that there just are some parents that just aren't going to do that. And we're going to use the public school systems to feed children. And they'll have lunch and breakfast during the summer when school's not in. They'll have that opportunity. And there it is. Well, we decided it was the school districts, so school systems, the school boards have voted on it. The legislature, Congress, has put money aside for it. We have decided as a society that this is how it's going to be. We can take issue with it. That's not the point, because I certainly do. But at this point now that we have determined that this is the direction we're going to go, well, what is going on here? Why are these ships not able, or why are these schools not able to get food to cook? Who's got these contracts? Who's making money off of this but not delivering on their end of the deal? And we're going to hear, well, there's these shortages, right? There's not enough truck drivers to unload. When they unload these container ships, there's not enough truck drivers to take their cargo and get it from point A to point B to point C and point D down the so-called supply chain. Well, then at that point, if you can't deliver on your deal, it's time to find another deal, right? It's time to find we need to have these contracts. And I think some of these contracts are pretty significant. These distributors make a lot of money off these school systems. These Cisco, whatever it may be. Are you telling me that maybe we don't. Maybe we need to rethink the way we do these contracts if we're having these problems. But if you have a fiduciary duty, if you have a signed contract, and you're one of the parties that's unable to deliver, then you need to look on the other side of it, and I would think maybe move on and find a new vendor or something. But there's something going on there. And there's all kinds of other avenues I think to consider. But that's what we're gonna talk to Josh about. That my problem isn't so much that what we do in theory, like I said, that's a discussion for another time, but we do it. And if we're gonna commit to doing something, then we need to do it. And it needs to be considered something essential. It'd be like saying to policemen, well, they don't have any bullets for their guns because the truck didn't get here on time. So what do we do? We're going to close down a police department. Or they don't have gas in their tank. Or, you know, we have an emergency situation. We have a guarantee here from a vendor. So the two school systems, Alexander City, they're in Tallapoosa County, and Dothan were the ones that were hit by this. So they just shut down their school systems doing remote learning. That was their response. That's not acceptable to me, especially as a taxpayer, where the tax money goes to these meals. And I would think, especially if you're a taxpayer in Dothan or in Alexander City, it certainly shouldn't be acceptable. 251-343-0106. Terry writes, feed the kids or buy weed, 40s and cigarettes. Come on, man. Well, it's like I said, Terry, though, we could have that debate till we're blue in the face, but we decided as a society that we're going to take care of these kids. We voted on it. We went through the democratic process. We endeared to politics, and we have come to this conclusion, and that's where we are. And we could go back and change it, but for now, that's where we are. And if we can't get to where we need to be based on what we have decided as in our system of government, then we got a problem. Let's see here. Thanks for the update on the app. Anyway, it brings me to my next point here, and I know some of you may have seen this floating around social media today. This is the Washington Post opinion column. Don't rant about short staff stores and supply chain woes from Micheline Maynard, a contributing columnist. And I read the first like four graphs. I get it. It's like learning how to be learning how to survive in these supply chain problems. They'll eventually be all right. But the point is, not to complain about them. That's not acceptable. We are where we are, guys, because of government policy showing that you don't have to earn money necessarily. You don't have to get out and earn it. That under the right circumstances, you could stay home and collect a check. And it's having a ripple effect all through labor. These very, very important jobs like truck drivers and look at, the contractors. People don't want to come to work because why would they? It costs them more to go to work than they can stay home and not make money. Maybe they can do it under the table, but that's not the kind of economy. We don't want a black market economy in America. And you heard in that last segment of the top of the hour news, some companies like Home Depot are just looking for other ways to get to transport goods to this country. And here we have the Washington Post. Don't rant about short staff stores and supply chain woes. This is like, don't worry about it. I'll be fine. We'll go back to, I guess, self-sustenance. They used to make fun of these people that went into a survivor mode. They would buy the freeze-dried food and build the bunker, waiting for the food chain disruptions What do you tell those people right now? I say this all the time about why we do farm subsidies, ag subsidies. Look, America derives its security, its stability. A lot of that is people don't go hungry in this country. When people start going hungry in this country, when it's more about the food, not necessarily having deadbeat parents that won't go out and buy their kids the food, but the food not being on the shelves at stores for them to buy, that's where you start to get a little bit of unrest. And the United States figured this out a long time ago, that the key to a stable government, a stable society, is making sure there's plenty of food at an affordable price at grocery stores, et cetera, at your market. I mean, this is the problem. This is the one of the lessons of the Great Depression, because during the Great Depression, that's when all these radical political ideas started coming into the mainstream. And they realized the root cause of that was, well, there are too many people going hungry. We got to keep that from happening again. And we've been able to pull this off for almost 100 years, nearly a century now. Now we're having some issues, and a lot of it is labor shortages. How did the Biden administration screw this up so badly? I know some of this started under Trump with the checks going out. But the idea that you could create a class of people that are dependent on the government and not have ripple effects, people are worried about what it has on your day-to-day lives because you feel it, but think about what it's doing to the treasury and the debt, the deficit. But it's the same thing you used to see in the old Soviet Union. David writes, just like if they get snow, we get snow flurries in Southwest Alabama, they shut down the schools earlier, they're closer day, it's a liability issue. If a kid gets sick because they're not fed properly, the school board and school system could be liable. That's nonsense. Shutting down the school until they can get proper levels of food is the only option the lawyer would allow. David, did you just make this up? What judge is going to say, mommy and daddy couldn't feed little Junior today, so they sent him to school and school didn't feed him, so the mommy and daddy are going to sue? I find the defendant guilty and the plaintiff entitled to $1 million in damage. I mean, that's far-fetched. Well, do you really believe that? No, and if they're getting that legal advice, sounds like very, very sad legal advice to me, David. Our government has been bypassed. It's only a front. That from unnamed texter. These politicians, here's why I question what you have to say there, unnamed texter, because these politicians sure are eager to come on these radio airwaves, see their name in print. Why go through the trouble of these presidential campaigns? If the government's really just a facade. Maz writes, when the checks are going out under Trump, it was government that was telling people they couldn't go to work. Yeah, fair enough. But when you start that trend, though, Maz, it's hard to go back from it. We're going to start sending everybody $600 a month or whatever. Oh, really? And then they get used to it, and they live that way, and they sit on their couch and smoke a bowl or whatever, rather than think about going back to work, and you get into that routine, and it's hard to break out of it. Not that I have ever experienced that routine, but it does sound nice. That, I think, is maybe some of the problems we're facing right now. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poor Show at FN Talk 106.5.
Sitting here at the Floribama, about to open up a big old can. Good times, unwind, falling out of love in the same night.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning. 251-343-0106. Mr. Our government has been bypassed, unnamed texter says. It's paid for by, and he misspells Pfizer. At least get the spelling of Pfizer right before you bring that conspiracy nonsense here to the text line. Jason writes this, too many restrictions on trucks allowed in the port. Now, we have a lot of truck drivers that listen to this show. Is that true? Are there more restrictions? And I know, well, you know, I can't imagine what the Port of Los Angeles or the Port of Long Beach is like under with Newsom and then the left wingers in charge. Do you have to be a union shop? What is, there's probably more to this story than we realize that's causing some of these delays. Because typically, I have a lot of faith in the market. If the market says, hey, we need more truck drivers to haul this cargo, people would figure out a way to do it if the price were right. There was a way to make money. But it sounds to me like, well, yeah, we're going to make it so burdensome that it's not worth your time. That you got to be aligned with the right ideology. You got to be aligned with the right people. I mean, that's probably true at a lot of places. Let's see. Maz, agree with that. We didn't miss a day from the farm, so we donated checks to the church. And then finally, a name texter. Oh, they own the majority of the GDP and also the mainstream media. That is a fact. Ricky, are you on a burner phone here? I don't know. That Pfizer owns, that Pfizer is a majority of our gross domestic product is not true. And they don't own the mainstream media, though they do advertise on the mainstream media a lot. It's the same company that brought us Viagra is now going to cure coronavirus. Figure that one out, ladies and gentlemen. No, but back to that point, we got some truck drivers out there. There's got to be more to this story than we realize as to what is the bog down? What is the shutdown here? Does the federal government need to intervene here? And can you imagine Donald Trump were in charge of it? And he said, we're going to take charge here. We're going to start moving trucks in and out of here. But I can totally see that. So Breitbart News, my colleague Joel Pollack, he comes on sometimes. He rode out there to the port of L.A., and went off the coast, and there's just container ships for miles waiting to come in. It's I think if you go to Breitbart.com, you can see it. Yeah, you just see out for miles. 66 cargo ships hover near L.A. Long Beach ports, and the locals have never seen anything like it. Here's what they're complaining about on local L.A. news, the pollution caused by the ships. All right. We need to take a look at the app. I think it's not functioning. Duckman writes a total lack of leadership at every level, private, state, local, and federal. Historic levels of incompetency due to separate realities between the middle and ruling class. Why is the CDC as of September changed their definition of vaccine and vaccinations? They've removed the word immunity. Hey, Jeff, a lot of problems with the trucking industry is it's us old-timer experienced truck drivers are retiring, and they're bringing in very young, inexperienced drivers, and they honestly can't fill the voids fast enough. I can see that, too. You just get tired of the system, and it's making it harder. Then finally, California law has restrictions on age of the truck, et cetera, temporary rollbacks of all regulations, and things will start rolling. Yeah, that's what I think needs to happen. That they need to take a serious look at doing what they need to do in this circumstance and then slowly roll back in those regulations to get things moving again. Like I said, go to Breitbart.com and look at our lead story and you see the picture. It's really something to see. Let's get a break here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Folks said that I would change my mind. Straighten up and do just fine.
I still love rock and roll.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning. We do appreciate it. 251-343-0106. Hit us up on that text line. So to come on the program, State Senator David Sessions will be with us. That's about an hour from now. Also, Justin Bogey from the Alabama Policy Institute has an op-ed we're going to get him on to discuss. So make sure, like I said, you stay tuned for that. But joining us now, I think we got him, Josh Moon, Alabama political reporter, on the line. Josh, you there?
I am, Jeff. Man, sorry about that. We're good to go.
Hey, thanks. Hey, man, thanks for making time for us. We always appreciate getting you on. You had an op-ed. I watched you guys talk about it on Sunday on the V, and I think, for conservatives, we've already decided that schools are going to feed children. That's hay in the barn. We could have that debate some other time. I think my concern here is, and it's just a failure of government, and that the supply chain issues have arose in our schools, and you go through and you name all the schools. But something that was really striking from reading this, that just the unawareness at all these levels of state government of what's going on, and that's to me a real, real, real shortcoming.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's really a conservative or liberal issue when we're saying we may have to close our schools because we can't get enough food in there to feed the kids. Because, and look, I want to make clear too, it's not the fault of anybody that this happened. You know, we've got supply chain issues all over the country right now, and it's because, the ports are backed up because of a variety of reasons. But what we have in the schools now is a problem that's going to shut them down. And you're right. The most alarming thing was, they called the governor's office and they're like, what? And they've known about this. The schools have been talking about this for months. Montgomery County schools, they're where everybody lives that runs state government. They were talking about this over 2.5 months ago. And so, it's been a problem that's been lingering there for all this time. And it's been a problem in other states. And other states have come up with a variety of very creative solutions to solve a lot of these problems. They can't solve everything and it's going to be out of the ordinary, but our people seem to just be like, well, it'll work itself out, I guess.
Yeah. Or we'll just shut the schools down and send them home. That's unacceptable. It's not so much looking for blame to place on anybody. I get it. I agree with you there, but I think ideologically you expect more out of your government. If we're going to pay taxes into a system, well, it's up to these guys to find a band-aid to get us through this rough patch. And there doesn't seem to be any, there doesn't seem to be any direction there. There doesn't seem to be any effort whatsoever there. It's like you said, we should have known these problems were coming. Let's think of Plan B. Maybe we reach out to places around the community, or we reach out to different retailers or whatever we need to do, just to get us through this rough patch, and we make some adjustments. Furthermore, I'm not an expert on what these public school systems do and their contracting, but I would think it's pretty lucrative that you get the Dothan school system school lunch contracted, probably going to make some money. That we need to reexamine that whole relationship and how these things are done as well. I just, from top to bottom, it's a failure of these school systems and government in a lot of ways that I just find very striking.
Yeah, no, it is. And listen, I feel bad for a lot of the local school systems because in a sense, their hands are a little bit tied, because, they don't have the funds to just go out and say, for example, some other states have come up with a plan where if they are going to be, they have items that they're missing, that they know that they're going to need, hamburger buns or, what have you. Well, they go to Sam's, they go to the local Sam's Club. And they make a run for the districts that need stuff there, and the state is providing them extra funding for doing that, and they're taking the money, of course, out of the COVID funding that they received from the federal government. But we don't have anything like that, and that's what I'm saying. It takes a variety of very creative solutions to overcome this very weird situation that they're in here, and that to me has always been the biggest criticism of our government and a lot of government entities out there that they just aren't nimble enough a lot of times to do the unexpected. You know, when an unexpected issue comes up, it's just like everybody throws their hands up. And that's essentially what happened here. You know, AL.com, which called the governor's office to ask about this. And they said, well, try Ag and Industry. You know, let's see if they have anything to say. And the guy at Ag is just like, oh, what? Why would you call me? You know, it was just such an unbelievable failure to address a problem that's going to affect, you know, tens of thousands of kids. You know, 700,000 kids rely on this on the food every day to have a decent meal. And I mean, should it be that way? No, it shouldn't. But you know, what are you going to do? Not feed the kids?
But it is. I mean, and yeah. we went through the political and the process, the government process, and Congress and the legislature and school boards have decided schools are going to play this role. I may disagree with it, but that's the way things are. They're going to provide a meal for people that are unable to feed their kids for whatever reason. But it's mm-hmm. done. It's like I said, it's hay in the barn. But what kills me, you and I are probably on the opposite ends of this whole critical race theory thing. But I tell you what, where we probably would agree on, it needs to be further down the list at the Alabama school board meeting than this problem. That needs to be number you know, 15 or whatever, and this needs to be moved up the list a little higher, I would think. I just these failures in government are what really frustrates people, and that's what makes them so anti-government, and that's what leads them to our way of thinking, I think, sometimes.
I agree. I think that things that actually are a problem need to be way higher than things that aren't. And I mean, it's just it's so frustrating to watch people who you know. In a lot of cases, I mean, we obviously have my disagreements with a lot of people that lead state government in this state on a lot of issues. But I also know that there are good people in our state government that want to do right and certainly want to feed kids and make sure that the schools are running properly and things like that. I know that that's how they want to do things. But to watch them fail, you know, at such a, honestly, something that should be the highest of priorities. And have you heard anybody talk about this? That's one of the things that we couldn't get past was it's not just that this was this huge problem out here. It's that nobody was even discussing it. You know, nobody was even talking about this thing. They had a whole legislative session and nobody even brought it up. You know, a special session. And they talked about prisons and using $400 million for prisons from the COVID money. But nobody even addressed the fact that we couldn't feed the kids at the schools.
Well, I you know, just not being aware of it, maybe but how many people that are involved in state government have children in school or they have constituents with these problems? I got to think there's a few out there, but for me speaking personally, this never would have crossed my mind as being a problem because, I mean, I know we're having some disruptions here, but I can still walk into a Publix or a Walmart and you know, most of what you need is there. It never would occur to me that you would have these many deficiencies throughout the state to where this would be that big of a problem.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, for people who have kids in schools, in public schools, you know, obviously, and I think that they've known about this because the schools have been sending out letters. Discussion of a lot of the parent teacher organization meetings. This was, you know, something that they've all talked about for a while, you know, that they were having these problems. And so I think a lot of those parents knew about it. And I think that kind of brings us to another problem, though, is we have a lot of people in our state government who are really out of touch with the regular people on a day-to-day basis. You know, when you start talking about just the working class people of the state, I'm not even talking about party lines here. There are a lot of people who are just simply out of touch with the people that go to work every day, drop their kids off at a public school, try to make sure that everything is running right, that they're getting their kids a good education and sending them to a good school. I think there are a lot of folks that are just kind of out of touch with that life.
Well, and you know, but this is like an annual discussion, right? Education reform, and we know all the different fixes and the disagreements there. But I think just like the basics, get the basics down and then we can start talking about school choice or we can get the lunchroom functioning, get yeah. you know, get make the classroom safe. get the firearms out of the school or whatever. And they will look at vouchers or whatever, right? But we're not really getting. I mean, it's not just math and the basic elements of education we're really coming up short on. It's just the basics of operating a school itself, it seems to be a struggle.
Yeah, there are some school test scores that were released not too long ago. They're really depressing. They really are. Our best school system in the state was 50% proficient at math. There were some that were well under 10%. And included in that was some charter schools that were around 2%. We're having a lot of problems in a lot of areas, getting kids up to a level where they can be proficient in the basics of things, which means that they can go into life and read and be able to do some basic math that they'll need, for their jobs or to further their education and to be hireable. And I think that reflects a lot of times in the workforce and in the jobs that are available to our people in this state. And if we don't start doing something and start upping the quality of our public education here in this state, then we're going to have some real problems, continue to have some real problems. We've got some opportunities where I think some people on both sides of the aisle are starting to agree on some things. And, it would be nice to get some folks in there that that really appreciated that and could do something about it.
Well, Josh, this is the struggle. Now, you hear every year record education budget, record teacher pay raises, and I figure we're mid-pack or somewhere maybe nationally when you adjust everything. Mm-hmm. It's how much of this, and I don't know that there's a necessarily government policy solution, but I want to bounce this off of you. Like, how do you get more parent involvement at home and in school with their children's schools? Does that issue comes up? And I don't know what you could do, and I don't think you could do it at the government level. But that seems to be a component that no one really has a good answer for.
There are some answers. The problem is that the answers are very hard. And mostly expensive. You look at something, give an example, and I'll give it a charter school example, the Harlem Day School. Look at the success rate that they've had. There have been some charters in Texas that have had enormous success at educating children that are in high poverty, high risk, environments at home. And, a lot of the answer is a sequestering those kids through the course of the week. It takes a unique approach in a lot of ways to solve unique problems. And that's what we have in a lot of our cities where we're having major struggles here. And we have some struggles in some other places where it's just simply a matter of allocating the appropriate funds to get teachers and the necessary training elements that are there in those public schools, in some of our rural communities out there that, Jackson County, for example, what they need is not necessarily some grand thing. They just need enough funding. If we allocated funding based on test scores and poverty levels, instead of the way we do it and make it need-based, more need-based than what we are, then I think we would solve a lot of the problems that we have in our schools. Now, it's not all funding, but funding pays for those quality teachers, pays for it to get it lower down the teacher-student ratios. Those things are very, very important. And I think if we can start doing that, then we could make some headway.
Finally, Josh, something totally unrelated. The Auburn season, I wanted to get you to bounce this off. It's going about as we expected. Is that a fair assessment, you think?
Yeah, no, I think actually, last week watching Bo Nix play, I thought that was, I don't know. What quarterback development looks like because I haven't seen it in so long. But I assume that's what it is a quarterback that steadily progresses over the course of the season and gets better and better each week. And if that's the case, then, I really appreciate that aspect of things. And I would have to say, objectively, I don't know really what anybody could criticize Brian Harsin and the group for there at this point. We all knew that there were some issues with on both lines of scrimmage, especially the offensive line of scrimmage, and it just you know, we just, I think that he's doing the best he can with what he's got to work with. And honestly, you know, I would say the guy's got an A grade at this point.
And I was going to say about a B+, maybe, you know, that you still are let down from time to time, but it's not unworkable, you know?
No. I think, compared to what it was, last year and looking at what they had coming back, I think the guy has done just about as good as he could possibly do. I mean, the Georgia game, but, you know, that should show everybody, where Auburn is right now. I don't know that there was anything that you could have changed necessarily in that game as a coach to perform better. And that's how far behind Auburn is compared to Georgia right now.
A play call or two here and there, I think. Some of those fourth down calls early on, you know, and what happened in the Penn State game. But anyway, that's enough of that. There's a sports talk station.
I think you're right. The Penn State game was the fourth down there was curious. I don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, he wanted to throw Bo Nix under the bus, but stopped just short, I think.
Josh, folks want to find out more from Alabama Political Reporter, or they want to check you out online, tell them where to look.
Yeah, we're at aoreporter.com online. You can get me on Twitter at Josh_Moon. And, hey, man, y'all check out the podcast, Alabama Politics, this week.
All right. Hey, Josh, thanks for making time for us this morning.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it, man.
All right, Josh of Alabama Political Reporter, ladies and gentlemen. We got to get a break in here. We will be back very shortly. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
I should have died out a long time before.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening. On this Tuesday morning, 55 minutes after the hour, so to come on the program, we'll hear from Justin Bogey. That's in the next segment from Alabama Policy Institute and State Senator David Sessions. A very, very active time of year for those of you running for re-election. Leo, there's an easy solution to the daycare problem. Go back to orphanages for the parents that can't fix their kids a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a small bag of potato chips to take to school. Leo, I don't like that idea, though. You take their kids away from them? How expensive would that be? Well, let's just come up with a dollar figure. I think parents that aren't able to feed, there ought to be punitive action. There ought to be something you can do. I don't know what it is. I don't think you could tell deadbeat parents to do better. It's not really the role of government. It's unfortunate. Maybe you could aspire them to try better, try harder. But not every problem in society has a government solution. That's just where us conservatives come in. We don't really rely on government to cure all of our woes. But culture is to where we're at a point where you can't criticize parents. So, your point, Leo, just think how expensive that would be to take kids away from parents and open up orphanages again. A little orphan Annie. Dell writes, here's the problem. Baby boomers who are currently run city, state, federal bureaucracies are horrible managers. So I agree with that. They are hanging on their jobs, performing poorly, and won't get out of the way of the Xers. Nomads, according to the fourth turning, who become the pragmatic midlife leaders during the crisis period. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. Let the Gen Xers fix what has been destroyed by the irrational. You know, I guess the bureaucracy, though, in government bureaucracy, there is that entrenched, you know, workforce. You get the government benefits, the money, the work is easy. There's no incentive to be ambitious. It's a job. You go do your job. You don't do more than is expected of you, and people thrive under that. It's very lucrative. And then Tim has Tim employing the Bob Barker method here. I don't think that's an exception. I mean, I'm serious. Like, you could tell me to do that, spay and neuter, Tim, but what is a serious solution to this problem? 251-343-0106. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 1065.
Carry on, sweet Southern comfort, carry on.
Bucks Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning. We do appreciate it. 251-343-0106. You want to respond to anything we are discussing this morning? Feel free to do so. Still to come on the program in about 30 minutes or so, we will hear from David Sessions, state senator from Grand Bay. We'll talk about special session, other things going on around the legislative scene. So please stay tuned for that. But join us now. Very pleased to bring on my next guest from the Alabama Policy Institute. He's Senior Director of Fiscal Policy there. Justin Bogey has an op-ed out. State government takes more revenue from citizens than ever before. Justin, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jeff. Doing well. It's nice to be with you.
Hey, thanks for making time for us. So I don't think this comes as much surprise. The last few legislative sessions, we hear about record education budget. And just people starting out, well, if maybe not enough people, but a few are starting to ask, well, if the government's taking in all this money, we're having budget surpluses, as we just learned from this whole prison debate. Maybe those tax receipts coming in, it's time to kind of lower them and give more of that money, put more of that money back into the public's hands, as you might expect from a Republican supermajority. But there's a hesitancy to go in that direction. But you've crunched the numbers. Walk us through what you've found out.
Yeah, sure. And there's really a couple of things we should be looking at, I think. And you know, from our standpoint, the state is spending too much money, so we could look at cutting some of the spending too. But also, when we have these record surpluses, then look at giving it back to the people. But kind of the short story here is that last year, the state brought in about $1.2 billion and more revenue than they did in 2020. So I don't think anybody was really expecting that, you know, it's been growing more slowly over the past couple of years, but $1.2 billion and more revenue. And a lot of that, you know, it's not just some magic pot of money that comes in. That's coming out of our pockets. About half of it was from individual income tax receipts. Corporate income tax receipts were up about 72%. Sales tax receipts were up. You know, really all of these big money makers for the state saw a significant growth last year. And so, you know, Alabama prides itself as a conservative state. So the conservative really policy option here would be to give some of that money back to the citizens. And that's what a lot of other states have done. So I think it's kind of time for us to ask, why isn't Alabama talking more about that or actively trying to do something?
And there's a reluctance to look, you know, you give it to the legislature since 2010. I think they budgeted appropriately. And some of their projections, they always lean on the conservative projections where they don't get too far ahead of their skis with regards to spending. But we don't exactly have what the experts would call as a progressive tax system in Alabama. They tax groceries. They get money in other places that, you know, from top to bottom, there are places that you want to look at cutting taxes, but I guess it's kind of the devil's in the details, what taxes you cut, where the cuts need to happen, and what's the most effective.
Sure. Yeah, and you know, you mentioned grocery tax, and that's something that we've been proponents of for several years now, for a long time. Alabama is only one of three states that still fully taxes groceries. You know, everyone, regardless of how rich, poor, whatever you are, has to buy groceries. So just, you know, eliminating that tax or phasing it out would be one way to help everyone in Alabama. The last cost estimate I saw on that, it was about $500 million, somewhere $500 to $530 million to get rid of that. Well, you know, we're sitting on a $1.2 billion windfall here this year. So that's something that could be done. But, you know, as I mentioned, a lot of other states are looking at cutting individual and corporate income tax rates. I think it's 12 states that have done it in their 2021 legislative sessions. All 11 of those cut individual income taxes, 5 cut corporate income taxes. Alabama had a bill a couple of years ago to cut the corporate rate to 4.5%. It's right now it's about 6.5%, so it's higher than a lot of our neighboring states. So that's something we'd love to see come back in the 2022 session, get more people talking about that just to make Alabama more competitive with our neighbors. I know North Carolina is in the process right now of trying to cut theirs. They're close to an agreement on that. So those are kind of common sense things that I think we could do that would help people, but also make this a better business environment.
Well, now looking at it, I guess there was this unexpected windfall coming from the SSUT, the internet sales tax. I don't know how they missed that, but that seems to be a big reason why the budgets weren't in disarray after the COVID shutdown. What do you think, though, if the economy does get sideways or something happens, some unforeseen event, can the state keep up and weather the storm that where they won't put themselves in a hole by cutting taxes?
Well, I think so, but there's also another issue going on here, too, that we can't ignore. The state has gotten directly about $4 billion from the federal government through stimulus bills. And, I saw a total the other day from the Legislative Services Agency. They estimate total payments to Alabama, if you include citizens, businesses, the PPP loans, all of that, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $47, $48 billion that have come into the state since COVID. So that's helped keep these numbers growing and really in better shape. So, eventually, in theory, at least, that federal money is going to go away. So if we keep spending more and spending like that money is going to be there forever, there's the potential of a cliff coming, somewhere down the road. All of that money has to be spent by 2024. So what happens then? So I think, lawmakers need to take a conservative approach to this, not let the budgets grow too much more just because there's money coming in right now, and really prepare for that day when that could happen. But you also have to keep in mind the state does have reserve funds. The Education Trust Fund has a couple of reserve funds. The general fund has a rainy day account. The rainy day accounts can, the Alabama Trust Fund, which funds those, has over $3 billion of it in it right now. They can't access that much, but there's, if there was a 1 or 2 year kind of blip in the economy where receipts went down, they could weather that storm. But I think it backed up the need for conservative budgeting and really reining in spending and not getting ahead of ourselves just because things are going well right now.
And the opponents, as far as I could tell, are some of these people that do have their eye on these surpluses, these special interests, that in some way there could be some government program. Maybe their constituency could benefit from a lot of education, I think, interest, whatever you think of their goals. But that seems to be the hurdle there, that they think this money ought to be allocated towards something.
Right, and that's another – it's kind of one of the structural problems with the Alabama budget. So much of the revenues coming in are committed, before a legislator ever gets a chance to have an opinion on it. About 91% was the last estimate I saw of the state's revenues are actually earmarked for certain funds. And, the two biggies are sales tax and income tax, which are all earmarked for education. So that becomes a battle with the Alabama Education Association over cutting school spending. But we're talking about a really large surplus here, so you wouldn't be actually probably cutting money from the education budget. It's just kind of that perception. And, another thing is the Alabama education budget, it's one of those, it's grown more than the general fund budget. It's continuing to increase every year. The rumors are that they're going to ask for another $400 million or so this year. That hasn't necessarily translated into better results for students, really. We're still always near the bottom in these national rankings. So I don't think the argument of throwing more money at education has really gotten the results that we want. So maybe it's time to look at other reforms to education to do that. So I don't really think there's a risk of, taking away money from education or anything like that. It's just using the money that we already have in more efficient ways.
But they're the political opponents. They're the opposition. They're the ones looking at this and thinking, wait, more money for education. You don't need to give this money back. That we have a Republican supermajority in both chambers, Republican governor. All the constitutional offices are Republican. They all ran on being conservative. I just think there's a disconnect there when we talk about conservatism and getting from point A to point B, that oftentimes that's not really how we govern, and it's reflected by the reluctance to push back. You mentioned Arthur Orr, state senator from Decatur, and he had mentioned just two very small tax cuts, giving that money back, and got, my understanding, he got a lot of pushback from a bunch of people inside the Montgomery bubble, that's kind of the attitude that we, you know, that if you're on this side of the issue, you've got to overcome that.
Yeah, he identified tax cuts for seniors and tax cuts for low-income individuals, which, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but I think we ought to be looking at something more comprehensive that benefits everyone instead of just a couple of selected groups. And he also mentioned raises for teachers and longevity bonuses for teachers, which, again, I'm not trying to, you know, downplay the importance of education by any means, but there was a pay raise approved for all state employees in the 2022 budget, so they're already going to be getting that this year. You know, if you look at stimulus money, the city of Birmingham gave bonuses to all city employees. The city of Mobile and Mobile County gave bonuses to employees. So it seems like that's kind of always the default that we go back to is, you know, let's just give bonuses to state employees or city employees or, you know, whatever the case may be, where, again, that doesn't help a lot of people in the private sector. That doesn't help the business owner that, you know, had to shut down for a couple of months because of COVID. So what can we do to help everyone instead of just these few selected groups?
Well, there's a perverse incentive here. We got money and we have to spend it or we lose it. That is sometimes the prevailing wisdom guiding a lot of these policies that don't really lend themselves to heading in the tax cut direction.
Yeah, but again, the $1.2 billion that we're talking about right now, that's the state's money. They can do whatever they want with it, really. So long as they can get agreement on a plan, the stimulus money, you're right. It's harder to put that back towards tax cuts. Although, you know, the American Rescue Plan, which was the last big stimulus bill that passed, it had a provision in it that kind of, was aimed at keeping states from using it for tax cuts, but that's been challenged. And a federal court has said that, you know, basically the federal government can't tell states what they want, what they do with that money. So I think there's still an opportunity there. But somebody in Montgomery has to want to do it. There has to be the leadership from the governor or from our high ranking legislators, to at least try to do it. You know, the default shouldn't be no. It should be, you know, let's try our best to find a way to do this, to give relief to every citizen in Alabama. And then if it runs into a problem with the federal government, we can't do it, then, you know, we'll deal with that as it comes. But the default seems to not even be able to be trying to do that, which, you know, again, I think that's kind of against the conservative principles that the state, you know, says that they stand for. So that's the issue there.
Yeah, I know you're a policy guy, but the politics seem to be this. Maybe if we don't talk about it, it will go away. That we won't have to talk right about this. It's an election year. If there was ever a time to make this an issue, it's right now, about this time in the cycle. This is what Republican primary voters should expect from their government. That lower taxes is something every Republican runs on, that's how they win their primary. That you know, the taking less from you and letting you keep more in your pocket is a tried and true Republican conservative ideal. But here in Alabama, it's maybe we'll just, you know, kind of talk around this. But by the way, I'm, you know, critical race theory, abortion, whatever.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you're exactly right. That isn't really what we've seen over the last three years, the last three legislative sessions. We've seen a 10-cent hike in the gas tax, which is now fully implemented, which, you know, by the way, they can raise that another cent every 2 years without ever having to vote on it again. We spent all of last session basically talking about medical marijuana and gambling, which are two things that, you know, medical marijuana is some people estimate it's up to an $8 billion industry in the U.S. right now. So you're potentially talking about hundreds of millions of dollars coming into the state for medical marijuana. Gambling, you know, the estimates out there were over $500 million a year if you had casino-style gambling and a lottery. So really all they've been focused on, it seems, is trying to bring in more revenue. And there's just been really little talk about giving any of that revenue back to the people.
Yeah, in the meantime, it's a lottery and all these different ways to bring in more revenue to the government, but it's never given it back. Anyway, hey Justin, we're going to get a break here, but folks want to find you online. They want to check out your work at API. Tell them where to look.
Sure, yeah, you can go to alabamapolicy.org. We've actually got a big report coming out on the state budget situation in the next few days, so we'll be talking about it there. We'll have the report there and writing some more articles to go along with that. So that'd be a great way to check it out.
Justin, we appreciate your time. Let's talk again soon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Justin Bogie of the Alabama Policy Institute. Let's get a break here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 1065.
You got to know when to hold them. And know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting.
Welcome back to the Jeff Horst Show on FM Talk 1065. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning. 251-343-0106. Vaccine mandate, guys. What they've set up some kind of link, I think. Whatever the website is that sends them directly to this show's text line. Or the station's text line. I don't know what's going on here, but you're really pushing it here. David writes, forget the Gen Xers. Put the first year millennials, 81 through 84, in charge. Our generation is a bridge generation between the new age and the old timers. Tell Grandpa Generation X to go rock on the porch and be quiet. David, I we always have these weird generational. Here's what's going on, and I think this is all clever marketing. Whatever the demo is at the time, whatever they've called that generation, when it was Generation X, when it were the millennials, the baby boomers, whatever that key target demo where you start making decisions. And wanting to buy products, they hype that generation up. These marketing companies hype that generation up as being wise, smart, the pulse of the future. We need to listen more to them. They are the and that's never true. The younger generations need to learn from the older generations. You got it backwards, buddy. And you know, think about where you were. When you were in that key target demo, when you were deciding what kind of soap you were going to buy, or what kind of paper towel you were going to use, or what kind of beer you're going to drink, when you start making these decisions in life and you develop these habits, that's the target demo. That's what advertisers want. So I think it's a clever marketing thing. So in the 1990s, we were going to really hype up Gen X, right? Generation Next, yeah. Oh, you know now. Now it's the millennials or whatever the next thing is. And they hype them up and they build them up. They put them up on a pedestal. And apparently a part of that is these guys are wiser than us older people. We could really stand to use some fresh blood or some fresh ideas. That's nonsense. It's all just to put these guys up and make them feel good about themselves because you're trying to get them as customers. That they're not, you know, we do this all the time. Anyway, 251-343-0106, still to come. David Sessions, State Senator from Grand Bay, will be with us here in a few minutes. Coming up tomorrow on the program, you're on Sean's show yesterday, but we got Katie Brick on the program, already for United States Senate. Also, my friend Phil Williams, also from API, but Right Side Radio up in Huntsville. And we'll wrap it all up with Sean Ross of SR Communications, as we do every Wednesday, but also he's the former editor of Yellowhammer News. Some interesting trends going on there. And we're about to go into special session here in a few days. So there's a lot to talk about there. 251-343-0106. But that's coming up tomorrow on the program. Please, please, please tune in and send me your relevant text to the text line. All right, guys, we got to get a timeout in here. We will return. This is the Jeff Borst Show at FM Talk 106.5.
A couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendant.
Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning, 34 minutes after the hour. Hit us up on that text line, 251-343-0106, if you would like to respond to anything we are discussing this morning. Joining us now, very pleased to bring on my next guest, always very kind to come on, State Senator David Sessions on with us. Senator, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Jeff. Doing well. Doing well. Good to be with you.
Hey, thank you for making time for us. We always appreciate it. Let's kick it off here. Special session next week, it looks like. How do you feel about it? Reapportionment, obviously, at the very front of that. It seems like I don't know if there's probably some very small things that are still being ironed out, but overall seems to be going in a good direction.
Seems to be. I think that's kind of the delay in not starting the 25th and putting it off to the 28th, give them a little more. A little more time to iron out the details. Of course, I'm not on that committee, so I'll probably see the maps for the first time when I get up there for special session.
Oh, so you have you haven't exactly seen the maps yet either?
No, I have not.
Do you have a general idea about your own district, though? At least I would assume.
Yeah, I think it's going to be okay. I think there's still some, you know, in Mobile County, we have three senators, and that's pretty much how it probably needs to stay because we haven't really grown in population. I think 100 people in the last 10 years, population shift. So I think we'll be within the variance. So I think most of the Mobile County will be, you know, pretty much as was or as is, but I'm not certain. Like I said, Jeff, I haven't really seen the maps.
Well, I suppose we'll get more on that. I guess next week when the committees do finally get done. But other than that, I mean the only things I'm hearing kind of a house seat or two here or there with some lines. But other than that. It doesn't seem like there's going to be too many. I mean, there's always controversy. The left will do what they do, but you guys got a super majority and you're probably in good shape.
We should be, you know, there's population shifts going on all the time. You know, we've had some big shifts in Mobile County. There's big shifts in, you know, Lee County and Bowen County. And, you know, it's just the, every 10 years, you can imagine that if something a plant closes down or something happens to where people want to move out of the city, they may go to a neighboring county or another part of the state. So you're always going to have those kind of shifts. So, but I think for the most part, you know, I've heard of a couple of House districts are not extremely happy. A couple of Senate districts probably not super happy. Like I said, I think that's the extra time to try and figure out a way to work on those.
Well, tell me this now. I guess reapportionment will be what it is. Yet, you know, House and Senate, legislative districts, congressional, and then obviously school board. But, will there be more in the call, or will there be an effort to add to the call
when we're talking about some of those? Yeah, I'm curious to see if the governor puts anything in the call to protect our businesses. Unfortunately, the Biden administration seems to think that a vaccine mandate is the direction to go on our businesses that have over 100 employees, and I certainly don't feel like that is proper. Jeff, I will tell you, I believe that people should get vaccinated if they want to, and if they're healthy. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I don't think the federal government should be mandating this, because there are reasons for people not to get vaccines. You know, I'm the mask mandate, you know, the mask may do good, it may not, but it's not going to hurt you. Vaccines are new, and I just don't think it's proper to do that mandate. And I don't think our businesses and their employees should be punished for that whatsoever. So, you know, that may be the only thing I could see her putting in the call with this redistricting, because redistricting is going to be tough. It's going to be, you know, it'll be a pretty tough battle. But I think we get it done. I don't think it's as near as quick of a session as the prison construction was.
Well, and you always run this risk. If you do add something else into the call, then it becomes something. It becomes something that could be used as leverage, used as a negotiating chip. And I guess the hope would be, if you're doing reapportionment, you want to kind of keep that quarantined and not have other things that could impact that discussion.
That's right. You know, you're 100% on it there. You know, everybody, you know, our number one objective on this session is to focus on the redistricting and hopefully get it done right, where there's, you know, we're going to get sued. I mean, the left is always going to sue. That's just part of it. I mean, and so, you know, we have to concentrate on getting these lines drawn. That's going to be be something that will hold up. And I think the committee is committed to that. And I hope that it works out that way. Like I said, it'll still have to be defended, but I think at the end of the day, it will draw up lines that'll be constitutionally and, you know, legally sound.
Joined by State Senator David Sessions here on the program. Senator, kind of looking back at a retrospective of the prison special session, Seems like things went probably about as expected. Have you got any update? I guess the big question there was, what would that federal money be available? And you guys operated as if it were going to be available. But sitting here today, any update on that? Or do you feel pretty good about where that special session ended up?
Yeah, I think that money is going to be available. It's kind of like federal grants and different things. You just, you know, if they allocate that money, it's really like they really can't tell you once they allocate it, if it's allocated and not specified, they can't tell you how to spend it or how not to spend it. So I think that revenue is certainly safe revenue to use. It's bad that I don't like the fact that we had to use it. I apologize to a lot of people in the medical community that, you know, unfortunately we're having to use CARES Act funds to help construct prisons. But, you know, Jeff, at the end of the day, one-time money like that, that could be used for that, it's kind of, you know, hard not to. I'd rather seen it go to something else, perhaps, but we're faced with a issue here that we have to address. And sometimes the solutions aren't really pleasant solutions that you really like to have, but it may be that it's the only solution available.
Senator, let's move into something kind of more in your wheelhouse here. You know, you're looking around the country and these supply chain disruptions and what's going on in the economy. More locally, I guess, looking at what's going on. Well, you know, how are things going in that arena? Particularly, you're a farmer and you're aware of all these issues, commodity prices, et cetera. But sure. Are things moving like they need to be? I know there's other variables, weather, et cetera, that farmers got to deal with. But are we starting to see some ripple effects coming down because of federal policy?
Well, I tell you, normally, like, we order our seed for next spring. We don't really worry or get concerned about ordering stuff ahead of time. But my brother and I and nephew had a conversation the other day, and we're going to order, you know, 4 or 5 months out ahead of normal. Just to make sure we can, you know what we can or can't get. It's getting a little dicey around, you know. Just, you know, unfortunately, our federal administration, the Biden administration, they have made mistakes at every turn. We've paid too many people too much money not to work. You've seen it in every industry, in every facet. Everybody in the world looking for help. And you compound that with just the regulations that are put on these trucking companies, and it's hard for them to get stuff moved. You know, I'm not 100% up to date with all the federal DOT, you know, the Department of Transportation policies, but these trucks can't run but so long, you know, and they have to stop. And, you know, it's just, it's hard to keep things moving like that. I mean, if the president wanted to help this situation, he would declare a state of emergency and remove some of these regulations that has all types of businesses at a disadvantage, and get things moving again. I mean, it's unfortunately just failed policy. And I mean, you know, he can brag about opening these ports 24/7s, and that's not going to do any good if you don't have anybody to, you know, hook to that trailer and get it down the road and get it where it needs to go. So, but it's a pinch. It's, you know, we're filling it and everything. There's a lot of product that we order that stays delayed or stays back ordered, or, you know, competition for a freight line to move it. Someone hires a truck out from under you. We had that happen several times this summer when we were trying to get product brought in. So, and I think it's probably going to get just a little bit worse before it gets better.
What do you think? Is anything that can be done at the state level? I mean, what Washington does is what Washington does, and that's, you know, that's 1,000 miles away or whatever. Here in Alabama, maybe we could alleviate some of these. What do you think? Is there something that can be done at the state level?
Boy, I don't know. You know, it's like that. So much of that transportation falls under federal rules. So many things that fall under them that the state really can't control or buck them on, that it's a difficult situation, you know. And I think, well, you know, the agriculture and timber business would benefit from a continued state of emergency to help move product around. Being able to run on highways that you normally can't run on, and you know, perhaps a little bit heavier load than normal with the portion tags, those type things can help a little bit. But there's not so much that the state can do to alleviate this problem. It's a nationwide problem, so you're talking about from state to state to state. So it's you know, I'd love to see them do a good infrastructure bill at the federal level and quit worrying about more stimulus money and giveaway money and feel-good programs and, you know, do something to help the country instead, because it's going to get bad. I mean, if it continues like it is, and you know, you're going to have inflation at 10-12% a year. And then if the Feds turn around and decide we got to slow that down and starts raising interest rates, Well, all of a sudden, all this surplus revenue that states have been enjoying, all of a sudden we're back to 2008, 2009, 2010. And we'll be having to dip into the rainy day funds again because we don't have enough money to fund government. So I can see a disaster coming down the road if at federal level we don't start changing some of those attitudes.
And you just got to hope for the best with these elections and that the country sees it the same, right?
I hope the midterms prove to be valuable. Bad thing, good thing is everything the Biden administration's done has been a failure. From Afghanistan to the border, to these mandates. And I mean, one reason Alabama is doing better than a lot of states is we have not had these mandates. we want people to be safe, but you can't shut down everything at one time, or it creates a bigger disaster than the health disaster.
Yeah, well, it makes these elections have consequences. I think it's the takeaway. Hey, Senator, we're up against a break here, but we appreciate you coming on, and let's get you on again real soon.
Always a pleasure, Jeff.
Hey, thank you for coming on. State Senator David Sessions there. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poore Show at FM Talk 106.5. To the Jeff Poore Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening on this Tuesday morning, or what's left of this Tuesday morning, I should say. We do appreciate it. Come up tomorrow on the program, U.S. Senate hopeful Katie Britt. She'll be with us. Phil Williams from the Alabama Policy Institute and Right Side Radio up in Huntsville will make an appearance. And then we'll wrap it up with Sean Ross of SR Communications and formerly of Yellowhammer News. But probably another guest to be named later. As always, twitter.com/Jeff_Poore. Are the Jeff Poore Show on Facebook. If you want to see the guest list about an hour or so before the program begins, that's where you can look. But you'll have to wait for tomorrow or any of a guest list or none of that nonsense, because right now you got the one and only, maybe under the weather, I don't know, Sean Sullivan for Midday Mobile coming up here shortly. What you got for us, Sean?
Well, it is some nonsense probably, but coming up on the show today, a couple things. Guest-wise, Sarah Kalian's going to join us. She's been on before. She's a cold case investigator, works in conjunction with the Mobile County Sheriff's Department, but pretty well-known name in the true crime discussions. I mean, she's done TV shows about this and podcasts about this. And people I talk to who consume a lot of that product go, oh, yeah, absolutely know her. Well, she works and helps out with the Mobile County Sheriff's Office in cold cases, so she's going to join us this next hour to talk more about that. Also, I got a question for you, Jeff. And I know you're younger than me, but you're a better student of history than I am. Are you feeling like we've joked that Jimmy Carter is very happy that somebody's now taken away the legacy for being adult of a president here? But aren't a lot of the things starting to come to the same way they were during Carter? I mean, are you seeing like analogs here in this? I mean, I was sitting thinking about it today, eating my lunch. I said, there's a lot of things that are kind of lining up the same way here.
Yeah, but do we have a...
Except Carter was better.
Well, do we have a Ronald Reagan figure that was a stark contrast?
Well, I don't think, Carter. Well, if we go the same formula, then that would make former President Trump Gerald Ford, right? And then you would have who would be the Ronald Reagan who would come in afterwards. I don't know, but...
Was it DeSantis or something like that? Does he come in and just clean house and kick ass and take names? I mean, there was a choice you could make, and we kind of saw one choice. The malaise speech.
Do you think we have, we'll call malaise speech two for President Biden?
I mean, that seems to be where we're going. I mean, this idea that, you know, this Washington Post op-ed.
Yep.
Up. So what? Deal with it. And it's like Jimmy Carter with the sweater, and you know, you need a dress warmer because you're not gonna be able to run your heat. That's yes. Coming, guys.
I feel like there's some analog here, so I'll talk about that as well.
All right, guys, you've heard enough of me today. We will try to do better tomorrow. Sorry, Phyllis, couldn't say goodbye. We'll try to remember that as well. This has been the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.